You're listening to The Parting Shot with H. Allen Scott.
We're doing something a little bit different today. We're getting political. Well, at least my guest is. Celebrated director Rob Reiner is worried about the rise of Christian nationalism, which is the use of Christian values to push a political agenda. And he's worried about the impact it's having on our democracy. To highlight this in the best way he can, he's doing what he does best. He made a movie about it. Reiner teamed up with director Dan Partlin to produce the documentary God and Country. In the film, Partlin examines how Christian nationalism distorts not only the constitutional republic, but Christianity itself. He does this by speaking with Christian leaders and showing the distinct difference between Christianity and Christian nationalism. For Reiner, he's very direct about laying some of the blame for the rise in Christian nationalism right at the doorstep of former President Donald Trump, pointing to his messaging and the events of January 6th as prime examples. One of the things I took from my conversation with Reiner was the need for empathy. That's one of the things that I personally feel like we're lacking in this country. Sure, you might have different views than I do, but I'm empathetic to why you feel the way that you do, and I respect it as your opinion. But that respect comes with an understanding of our shared laws and rights. And that one thing is clear from the outset. Whatever your religious beliefs are, they should never impart on my rights as an American, as outlined in the Constitution. I'm not a religious person, but I do believe in the Constitution. It reminds me of a great Joan Allen film from 2000 called The Contender. She was nominated for Best Actress. I personally feel like she should have won, whatever. Allen plays a nominee for vice president, and she's going through a Senate hearing, and it's wrapped up in a big sex scandal. It's a dramatic movie. I highly recommend you watch it. But part of her being an atheist, the character being an atheist, is a big part of her story. And in her closing argument, she says, "Now, I may be an atheist, but that does not mean I do not go to church. I do go to church. The church I go to is the one that emancipated the slaves, that gave women the right to vote, that gave us the very freedom that we hold dear. My church is this very chapel of democracy that we sit in together, and I do not need God to tell me what are my moral absolutes. I need my heart, my brain, and this church." I love that line. It is such a good bit of line. It's just so good. And to me, that quote has always stood out as sort of the very foundation of why the Constitution and the separation of church and state is just so, so important. And I love the idea of like the Constitution being my faith, because it's just so matter of fact and factual, which as someone who loves going by the book and facts, I definitely love that. Anyway, yeah, you have all of that to look forward to in my chat with Rob Reiner. But of course, I can't not ask him about some of his movies. So I had to ask him about two of my favorite movies of his, The American President, but really one of my favorite movies of all time, Misery. So definitely wait for that for the end of the chat, because it's a fun one. He has a good answer to my question about Misery. So let's get to it. Go on and grab a snack, because I will be right back with Rob Reiner.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Rob, I have to say, it is a huge honor to meet you. I have been a fan of yours for a long time. My mother's a fan of yours. Like, I feel like it's generational at this point that I'm just continuing to be a fan of yours. So it's a real pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
When they first approached me about talking with you, I have my own sort of background with sort of Christianity. I was raised Mormon, and then the gay thing happened and that didn't work out so well. And so I converted to Judaism later. And so I've definitely been through the ringer with Christianity in general. And so I really responded to the approach of the film and the conversation in general on sort of what's happening today with Christianity, but also with Christian nationalism. And like, what made you want to produce and put your name on a film like this?
Well, first of all, we have to make a distinction between Christianity and Christian nationalism, because when you watch the film, you'll see that we have some very, very respected conservative Christian evangelicals who talk specifically about how not only is Christian nationalism hurting the country and hurting democracy, but it's hurting Christianity itself. Mm-hmm. And they believe that it is a terrible attack on Christianity. What made me want to get involved is I saw a movement happening in the country that was taking us further and further away from democracy. It started for me, the awareness of it back in the 80s and the late 70s and early 80s when Norman Lear started the People for the American Way. And I saw this this movement to kind of push a certain agenda down everybody's throat. And I didn't think much about it at the time in terms of what kind of political power they would attain. But I've seen over the years that they're incredibly organized, incredibly well-funded, and have attained tremendous power. And I saw that supporting Trump's candidacy in 2016, again in 2020. And now it's really hardened and solidified behind Trump.
Yeah.
And to me, this is a dangerous path for this country to go down and for the world to go down, which is authoritarianism. The idea that it's my way or the highway, and that you're even willing to resort to violence to get your own way. We saw this exemplified in January 6th. Mm-hmm. And that to me is setting the tone for something that could be much, much worse down the road. So when I saw this, when I was given this book by Steve Okun from Anonymous Contact, it was called The Power Worshippers by Catherine Stewart. I said, oh, this is really a great piece of work that shows just how organized, just how powerful this movement is, Christian nationalism. And I turned to Dan Partland. I said, come on, let's see if we can make a documentary about this, because people have to be made aware of the drive that's happening in this country. And like I say, we have very conservative Christian leaders, thinkers, devout Christians in the film talking about the danger of Christian nationalism not just to the country, but to the church itself and to Christianity itself.
And I think that it made me think of, so when I was a kid, my grandpa was a very much a strict Mormon, very strict Mormon. He very much a devout Christian in a lot of ways. But my earliest memories of my grandpa is that he hated Ronald Reagan because Reagan brought Christianity into politics, he thought, and it changed the Republican Party. And he was like, religion has nothing to do with politics. They should be separate. He really believed that. And that was one of my earliest memories. And looking back, that really was the start of it wasn't the start, but it was a big, big impetus with Christian nationalism. And it's just, the film does a great job of sort of showing its growth in small ways to where we are today. I wanted to know, how do you think Christian nationalism has evolved since Reagan to today?
Well, it's evolved considerably. When you think about the beginnings of this movement happened in 1954, there was the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling, which said that everybody had to be treated equal in terms of where they could access education. And this was not taken well by a big swath of the population. They just didn't like this idea. So they created religious schools where they could keep black people from integrating the schools. And it started this movement of bringing religion, or their idea of a religion, it was the KKK, the Christian Identity Movement, of maintaining this separation between blacks and whites. But it's kind of ugly, if you think about it, that that would be the basis of a political movement is we'll all be racists. And that's what'll, you know, we'll separate the races and that will be our rallying cry.
It sounds like an episode of All in the Family, really, if you think about it.
It didn't really take root, you know, but then along came Roe v. Wade in 72. And by 73, this became the galvanizing issue for Christian nationalists. They latched onto that and became a linchpin. It became the thing that drove the movement. And then over the period of time, we saw the Federalist Society getting involved in making sure that judges were put in the right place and getting them onto the Supreme Court, and all the way up to Trump, you know, putting three judges on the Supreme Court, and we see Roe v. Wade overturned. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a growth pattern over the decades of how Christian nationalism gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. But your father talking about the separation of church and state and not wanting these two things to be separate, that is in the Constitution. There are three mentions of it in the Constitution, and Christian nationalists will say out and out, there is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. They just lie about it.
Yeah.
It's information. So your father is right in that the separation of church and state allows religions to grow and to gives people the freedom mm-hmm. to pray and worship however they want. When you impose a religion on a country, it discounts everybody else's beliefs and thinking. Yeah. And that's the reason why the settlers that came to America were running away from religious persecution. They wrote a constitution that said that the state will make no religion, mm-hmm. that this country will make no religion. And so it's the Christian nationalist movement is totally antithetical to that. It says that it's my way or the highway, and we'll resort to violence if we don't get our way, which is what we saw happen on January 6th.
Yeah. One of the things that when watching the film, I mean, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and a suburb in St. Louis, and there was a big deal in my community where it's called Meacham Park, and it was an all black high school. And it was the first. And then, of course, when it went away, it really sort of hurt the community and people didn't know where to put kids. And it was, I mean, race was a big part of it. And when I watched the film, I was so surprised at I'm not surprised at racism being sort of the root of many problems in this country. But I was surprised at the role of sort of Roe v. Wade and racism within sort of the early starts of Christian nationalism and how that was really sort of the impetus in the beginning of sort of how a lot of this got started. I wanted to know if that surprised you and if there was anything that you learned over the process of producing this that you were surprised by something.
Well, the thing that I was most surprised by is to see, like I say, Christian leaders, conservative Christian leaders, talk against Christian nationalism. Because they believed it was not only hurting the country, but hurting Christianity. That was surprising to me. We knew we had to include them. They had to be part of the discussion because we're talking about Christianity. And certainly a Jewish person, you know, a lot of people say, well, you have no right to talk about this. You're Jewish. Why should you comment on the state of Christianity? And I tell people, for those who want to hear, is that I was, you know, I'm Jewish. There's no question about it. But I was raised in a secular household. There was no practice of religion. We were not religious at all. And when I went through a very dark period in my life decades ago, I did a lot of searching and soul searching and reading up on Christianity and Buddhism and Islam and Judaism. And I read all of it. And I came away personally with my own beliefs, which is the teachings of Jesus, which is love thy neighbor, do unto others as you would do unto your, you know, as you have done unto you. And that's what I took away. And so I thought, boy, this movement that they have here seems completely antithetical to the teachings of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, they believe in the death penalty. They believe in, more guns. Jesus was about peace and love and helping thy neighbor and those less fortunate than ourselves. And I thought that was something that we should all aspire to.
Yeah.
So this is, to me, this movement is going totally opposite the teachings of Jesus.
Well, and that's what's so compelling for me. And one of the reasons why I first responded to the film is that, you know, like yourself, I had to go through a pretty dark path of figuring out who I was. And I ended up with Judaism, but it took a lot of reading and it took a lot of figuring out and figuring out sort of different cultures and different religions. And one of the things that I love about the film is that it really does very distinctly say, this is not about Christianity, because even Christians are saying this is bad for us. This is a bad direction for us to go down. And Christians are already hurting with the PR program. So like the film is really eye opening in a lot of ways. I wonder if you like what you hope sort of more middle of the road Christians are going to take away from a film like this.
Well, I think hopefully it'll spawn a discussion. I mean, a lot of people who are unwittingly being drawn into this movement, not knowing, it gives them a sense of power, it gives them a sense of belonging. But if they really look at it and they really talk about it with their friends and listen to these very respected people like Russell Moore and mm-hmm. Phil Vischer and so on, they might start thinking, wait a minute, I might be getting away from those teachings. I might be moving into a direction I shouldn't be moving into. That's the hope, that we can spawn a discussion and that it can not only reach people who are of the same faith, you know, and make them understand where their faith is moving, but also people of other faiths to say, you know, we all have to live together in one place. That's the wonderful e pluribus unum of it all.
Yeah.
Out of the many come one. I mean, you say you had to go through a soul searching process mm-hmm. and you came to where you have. We want everybody to think about that, not to just accept dogma and go down a path that may be leading to a very, very bad place. We saw the beginnings of it in January 6th. It could be a lot worse. Going forward. So, I mean, you know, you were a Mormon. Yeah. And I think if you look even at the Mormon church right now, mm-hmm. they're way more accepting of gay and, LGBT. Yeah. They're way more accepting than they were, let's say, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I and my wife started the American Foundation for Equal Rights, it was all about creating marriage equality. And we filed the first federal lawsuit, and we were opposed mainly by the Mormon church.
Yep.
But as time went by, even the Mormon church started, wait a minute, you know, we can't be so harsh here. Yeah. You're seeing the Pope
yep.
now talking about they don't have to perform gay marriages, but they should recognize them and say, these people, they love each other.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with that? And when we teamed up with Ted Olson on this marriage equality federal case, he said he's a very conservative, was a solicitor general for George Bush. Mm-hmm. He said there's nothing more conservative than marriage and people loving each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's what comes across in the film, that it's conservative and it's loving to say we should all accept each other. That's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So, hopefully people will watch the film and start having discussions with people about what it means to blindly follow something that could lead you to a very dangerous place.
Yeah.
And I don't care what, Trump says. He calls, the insurrectionists, he calls them hostages.
Yeah.
They're lawbreakers.
Yeah.
They did a violent act. They did something very violent and they should pay a price for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going in a very dark place right now unless we're careful. I believe that we as people will find a way to let the good part of ourselves come forward and
I think so too.
Do the right thing. Yeah,
I think so too. One of the things that I find, I mean, we both live in Los Angeles. There's sort of a coastal mentality. And one thing that bothers me actually as someone from the Midwest is when people on the coast are like, oh, well, those Christian conservatives in the Midwest, they're crazy in the South. And they're just crazy following Trump around. And I tend to lead with a little bit of empathy to understand why they have chosen to go in this direction and support these Christian nationalists and support Trump in these ways. And I wanted to know if you, in sort of doing the film, looking at it, you know, I think a lot of people on the coast think, oh, it's a small part of the country. It's no big deal. Like, it's not, we shouldn't be spending too much time on it. Do you think it's bigger than what even people on the coast think it is?
It is, and it's not as big as many think. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 25%. 25 to 30% of the, it's just a big chunk of the country,
yeah.
25%, but it's a hardened 25%. And anything that is that hardened can cause a tremendous amount of damage. And that's what we're looking at. So you'd say, well, you can't win an election with 25%. Yes, you can.
You can, yeah.
And the way you do it is because of the system we have with the Electoral College, all you have to do is flip some votes in five or six states, mm-hmm. because there are states that will vote Republican, there are states that will vote Democrat, and they're off the table. They're not going to play a role. But in those 5 to 8 states, if you can flip enough votes in those very close states with a support group of a support team of 25%, mm-hmm. you can win.
Yeah.
You can win. And then you're down. Then you're going down the authoritarian path, and it's very, very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you know, like I said at the beginning of our chat, like, I have a generational history with you. I know your politics. I support your brand. I support your films. I pay the tickets to go see your movies. I own most of your movies. So, like, we have a relationship with you. And one of the things that I wonder is, do you ever, because you are so outspoken politically and you have been for years, do you ever worry about your politics perhaps getting in the way of people receiving the message of the documentary or the message of the film?
Of course. I mean, you know, half the country thinks I'm a libtard. I'm an idiot. You know, I mean, for opposing Trump the way I have over the years, you know, and that comes with the territory. That's fine. But I urge people, if they look at this film or they look at, you know, what I talk about, they may see something that they, you know, don't have a knee-jerk reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, really think about what we're talking about here. This is, yeah, there's no question about it. They, you know, listen, they got me, you know, visiting, you know, I have a summer home on Epstein's Island, the way they write about me, or I'm, you know, I'm a pedophile. I'm doing all kinds of crazy things.
All lies. Yeah.
I know. And it's tough. You know, there's disinformation and they've got the internet. But the truth is, you know, I do love the teachings of Jesus. I've loved them from the time I can, like I say, was during a dark period of my life. And I believe that good wins out over evil. And I think that we're all decent people, and that even the people who are entrenched in the Christian nationalist movement, we have to have forgiveness if it doesn't work out, or even if they wind up attacking more, whatever. Down the road, at a certain point, you have to forgive.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when the that terrible thing happened at the church in South Carolina, where the people were killed, you know, by this white supremacist person, and they all of the survivors of the loved ones, they all forgave that person.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's real Christianity.
Yeah. Those are real angels walking on earth.
Christianity. To say that person, as evil and as horrible an act as he committed, mm-hmm. he is misguided and he's still a part of the human race. And, you know, God love him, because, you know, something happened to this guy, mm-hmm. and it was a bad thing that happened to him, but we still have to pray for him and love him, and hopefully he'll be okay. But that's the tough thing.
Yeah.
That's the tough part of being somebody who believes in the teachings of Jesus. That's not the easy part. Mm-hmm. And the real, you know, people who believe that, you know, it's to turn the other cheek. I mean, you've got to, you know, it's tough. It's tough to do that.
Yeah.
If somebody's attacking you, you got to defend yourself. Yes. When they're physically on top of you, yeah. But, to force your ideas, your political ideas on somebody at the point of a gun, that's not the way Jesus taught. He didn't talk about that.
Well, and also having, I mean, one of the things, and this is something that I took from the film too, that having empathy for sort of a change in thought with, especially with a lot of Trump voters who, you know, even a lot of the people on January 6th, they talk about how they were indoctrinated by sort of the language coming out of Trump, and they're open about where their headspace was, and social media plays a part in that, and Trump played a part in that. There's a lot of things, a lot of voices that played a part in that. But having empathy for those people.
Yes, of course. Of course you do. Because look, you know, everybody talks about a cult of personality, and Trump is a cult, and people follow the cult. Cult people are vulnerable people.
Yeah.
They're people who are lost. They're looking for something. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for strength. They're looking for a direction. And you can get swept up in something. So you have to have sympathy for those people. And you have to say, I'm sorry, you know, you feel empty or lost or whatever. And you chose this direction to go on because it seemed like the right thing to do. But, you know, you find that it's, and a lot of those people did say, you know, I was wrong. I did the wrong thing here.
Yeah.
And so you got to love them. You got to love them.
Well, and you're also not going to win any votes over if you just completely ridicule people all the time for doing something one way or voting one way or supporting one candidate. If you write someone off in that way, they're never going to be able to be persuaded to vote your way. You know,
that's true. I mean, the people who are following Trump right now, I would say they're very hard to convince.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's hard to convince somebody who's stuck in that, you know, mindset. But down the road, they may say, you know, I was wrong about that. You know, you get older, you go, gee, I shouldn't have done that, or that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. You can't. I can criticize Trump because he's the one who's, you know, roping these people into this thinking, and you look, they all love me and all that. And they said he's anointed by God and, you know, he's their retribution, but he's using language like vermin and, you know, poisoning the blood of the country and all that stuff. And it's, wow, you know, this is scary stuff.
Wild.
Especially
stuff.
If you're a Jew, you know. You know what could happen to people who say, yeah, it's all their fault, you know.
Yeah, when you start pointing fingers, you get in dangerous territory, for sure. Yeah, well, one of the things, I mean, you being the Hollywood legend that you are, I always think about sort of the role that Hollywood has in sort of shaping a narrative for the country. And one of the things I love about your films and the work that you have done is, a lot of it, some of it is entertainment, but a lot of it also has a message. It has a point to it. There's a meaning behind it that maybe you can take away from it. And I wanted to know, what role do you think Hollywood has in sort of telling stories like this film and just in shaping the narrative for people so that we have a perspective on where we are as a culture?
Well, I think it's up to the filmmaker, you know. I mean, not everybody, you know, the first thing is to entertain.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're making fictional films, you know, is to entertain. And so that's your first order of business. If you want to bring, you know, issues into it, to talk about a specific thing, that's fine. As long as you can do it in the context of entertainment. That's why this film, God and Country, is a documentary, because we're saying this is happening in the country. We're not, you know, it is entertaining on a certain level, which is it's informative and interesting and you're engaged in it, but it's not there to, you know, take you on a Barbie ride or something like that. You know, it's a different kind of thing. My personal thing is I like to blend comedy, drama, satire, issues together if I can in some way, but I certainly don't want to hit anybody over the head with any messages. And that's up to the individual filmmaker. And I don't know that Hollywood, you know, if you look at Hollywood over the years, they have certainly reflected the culture, but in terms of making any kind of significant change, very few films by themselves do that. I think I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang did change the criminal justice system a little bit, but very few films do that. Mostly they spark conversation, and maybe that leads to something. The one thing I learned from Norman Lear was that you could take your celebrity or your fame, whatever, from what you've done and use that as a platform to push you know, certain ideas that you had. Yeah. In one case, that was for me, was marriage equality. Earlier than that, I did the thing for early childhood, which I cared a lot about. So I can do that, but I would do that as separate from, you know, the work I do in a film.
Yeah.
Although I have done films that are politically based, you know, Ghosts of Mississippi and A Few Good Men and Shock and Awe.
Well, I have to say, and I can't, I only have two more questions for you, but I can't spend any time with you and not bring up, well, one film in particular that I think is, it made, I thought about this film a lot in watching the God and Country, but also just in thinking about you and the impact that it had on me, The American President. So I went into I worked in politics for a number of years before I decided to leave and become a stand-up comic and writer and journalist and do things like this. But I watched The American President and I fell in love with the process of politics. And it just was, it was, of course, it's romanticized and it's, and it made me watch Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I was a kid, but I was, it got me in a domino effect of watching these kind of stories and seeing that. Right. And then I went into politics and worked in fundraising. And it was, I see the root of that with The American President. And it, that film to me, it's idyllic and it's fake and it's not real, but there's a hopefulness that when I watched God and Country, I actually went that night, and I own it, so I watch it all the time, but I watched The American President as well, because it's a world that I kind of want to live in, you know?
And
I wanted to know if you know the impact that that film has had on generations of people, but also if you think it's okay for us to maybe hide away for 2 hours and live in this fake little world of The American President and feel happy.
Well, sure, sure. I mean, it's called, you know, it's called divertissement and getting away from things. But you also aspire to something with it. It may not be exactly how it is, but you aspire to reduction in fossil fuel emissions. You aspire to, you know, meaningful gun safety legislation. You aspire to these things, and maybe they can happen. And even in the documentary, even in God and Country, at the end, you have Reverend Barber talking about what Christianity can do for the world, what it has done and what it can do. And it's very hopeful.
Yeah.
So it can be uplifting even when you're talking about a very serious subject.
Yeah. Well, my last question for you is, and this has nothing to do with anything we've discussed, but I have to ask you about it because it is perhaps one of my top 10 films of all time. I watch it probably monthly, Misery. The impact that Misery has had on my life, you would have no, I mean, your work in general has had a massive impact on me, but Misery in particular has just, it's become a part of my narrative. It's become a part of what I say with, I quote it to my boyfriend all the time. Like, it's a constant thing in my life.
Well, what line do you quote to him?
All of them. All of her dirty birdies. I mean, like, literally everything
didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car.
It's, I want to know if, like, if you, because that felt, out of all of your films, that one feels so out of the norm for what you normally do.
Yes. On the surface, it would seem so because, you know, I haven't made horror films and the thriller is the only one I've made, but at the core of that film is about a guy who has gotten very successful writing a certain kind of book, who wants to break away from that and write something more personal and more something more out of himself, and is worried that if he does that, his fans will not just desert him, but actually kill him. And when I was doing All in the Family, after I left All in the Family, I wanted to become, I had been director. I had directed my own improvisational group when I was 19. I directed a theater here in Los Angeles. And that was always what I wanted to do. And so when I did All in the Family, I got, you know, typed as a sitcom actor, and I wanted to do something else, and nobody wanted to take a chance until I eventually got Spinal Tap off the ground. But the idea of doing something different than what you had done and worrying that you're destroying yourself or you're going to ruin your career or whatever, that was at the core of misery. And that's what I could relate to, that somebody would really get mad at you if you did something other than what they expected you to do.
I love it. I love that you keep, you know, raising the expectations of us for the work that you do. And it was really an honor to be able to chat with you today. I really appreciate
thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.
Let me know what you thought of today's episode. I'm H. Allen Scott on everything. And, you know, leave a little rating and review. It does help me out a lot. It really does. And there needs to be more of them. I know you're listening, so go leave that rating. For the latest news and podcasts, head to Newsweek.com and follow Newsweek on all the social platforms. And while you're at Newsweek, be sure to subscribe to my newsletter For the Culture. It's really fun. We had a great time with the Super Bowl for the newsletter. So you can go on and go read those old ones, too, because they're funny, in my opinion. Until then, watch something fun and have a great day.